Graf Otto flew on through the airy canyons of the sky with the eternal snowfields and the gleaming glaciers of Mount Kilimanjaro towering high above them and casting their shadow over them. The butterfly was tossed about wantonly by the winds that swirled around the mountain's three extinct volcanic peaks. Then she broke free of Kilimanjaro's influence and sailed out into the sunlight. But there was another mountain range directly ahead of them, and Meru was so different from the great massif they had left behind. Ava fancied that if Kilimanjaro was the male, Meru was the female. She was lower and gentler in aspect, covered with dense green forests rather than harsh rock and ice. Henny Durant gestured to Graf Otto, indicating the new course. He banked sharply along the lower slopes of Meru and flew on past the town of Arusha that huddled at the foot of the mountain. Then Henny pointed ahead, and they all saw the white gleam of the crenellated walls of Fort Uzza sitting above the river. As they flew closer, they could make out the flag upon the central turret, which billowed in the light breeze, the twin-headed black imperial eagle of Germany, on a ground of red, yellow, and black. Graf Otto flew low past the white walls, and the uniformed figures on the battlements looked up at them. A staff motor car drove out through the main gates and headed towards the open ground along the bank of the Uzza River, dragging a pall of dust behind it. The Graf nodded with gratification. The vehicle was one of the latest models from his own factory. There were two men in its back seat. As Graf Otto had requested, a strip of ground had been cleared parallel to the river bank in preparation for their arrival. The earth was as raw as a ploughed field, and uprooted trees were piled haphazardly along the edge. At the far end, a windsock floated from the top of a tall mast. The layout of the landing ground was exactly as he had stipulated it should be in his cables to Colonel von Letter Vorbeck. Lightly, he touched down and let the butterfly run to where the staff car was parked. A uniformed German officer stood beside the open front door of the vehicle with one booted foot on the running board. As soon as Graf Otto had clambered down the boarding ladder, the officer came forward to greet him. He was a tall, spare but broad-shouldered figure in a field-grey tunic and a felt-covered tropical helmet. He wore red and gold staff officer's tabs on his collar and the Iron Cross first class at his throat. His clipped moustache was flecked with grey, and his regard was direct and piercing. "Count Otto von Meerbach," he asked, as he saluted smartly. "I am Colonel Paul von Letter Vorbeck." His voice was brisk and precise, given to command. "Indeed, Colonel. After all our correspondence, I am delighted to meet you." Graf Otto shook his hand and examined his features keenly. Before leaving Berlin, he had made a special visit to Army headquarters on Unter den Linden, where he had been given access to von Letter Vorbeck's service record. It was an impressive document. There was probably no other officer of equivalent rank who had seen as much active duty as he had. In China, he had taken part in the campaign to put down the Boxers. In German Southwest Africa, he had fought under von Trotha during his ruthless genocide of the Hereros. 60,000 men, women, and children had been exterminated, more than half of the entire tribe. After that, von Letter Vorbeck had gone on to command the Schutztruppe in the Cameroons, before being given the same task here in German East Africa. "Colonel, may I present Fräulein von Wellberg?"
"Enchanted, Fräulein," von Letter Vorbeck saluted again, then clicked his heels and bowed as he held open the door to the staff car for Ava to take her seat in the back. They left Gustav and Henny to secure the butterfly and drove up towards the fort. Graf Otto came directly to the main business. He knew the colonel would expect and appreciate a forthright approach.
"Has our visitor from the south arrived safely, Colonel?"
"He is waiting for you in the fort."
"What do you make of him?
Does he live up to his reputation?"
"Difficult to say. He speaks no German or English, only his native Afrikaans. You will have some difficulty communicating with him, I fear."
"I have made allowance for that. One of the men I brought with me is an Afrikaner. In fact, he fought under De La Rey against the British in South Africa. He also speaks fluent English, as I know you do, Colonel. We shall have no trouble in communicating."
"Excellent. That will certainly make matters easier."
Von Letter Vorbeck nodded as they drove through the gates into the interior courtyard. "After your journey, you and Fräulein von Wellberg will want to bathe and rest for a while. Captain Reitz will conduct you to the quarters that have been prepared for you at 4 o'clock. That is, in 2 hours' time, Reitz will return and bring you to the meeting with Delaray." As von Letter Vorbeck had promised, Reitz knocked on the door of the guest suite at precisely 4 o'clock. Graf Otto checked his watch.
"He is punctual. Are you ready, Eva?"
Punctuality was something he expected of everybody around him, including her. He looked her over from the top of her shining head to her small neat feet. She had taken care with her appearance and knew how lovely she was.
"Yes, Otto, I am ready."
"That is the Fortuny dress.
It suits you admirably,"
he called Captain Reitz, who entered and saluted respectfully. Behind him, Henny Durant stood in the open doorway. He wore a fresh shirt, had shaved and slicked down his hair with pomade.
"You look very smart, Henny," Eva told him.
He had sufficient rudimentary German to understand her and blushed with pleasure under his tan.
"If you are ready, will you please follow me, sir?"
Reitz invited Graf Otto, and they followed him along the stone-flagged passageway to the circular staircase that led up to the battlements. There, on the terrace, Colonel von Letau Vorbeck waited for them under a canvas awning. He was sitting at a heavy teak table, on which was set out a selection of drinks and refreshments. At the far end of the battlements stood another tall figure in a black frock coat. His back was turned to them and his hands were clasped behind it. He was staring out across the river at the bulk of Mount Meru, which hovered in the distant mist. Von Letter Vorbeck stood to welcome them, and once he had inquired politely as to the comfort of their quarters, he eyed Henny with interest.
"This is Durant, the man I told you about," Graf Otto introduced them. "He rode commando, this Delaray."
At the mention of his name, the black-clad figure standing at the far end of the battlements turned towards them. He was in his 60s, and his silver-shot hair had receded to leave his forehead high and domed. The skin was white and smooth, where it had been protected by his hat from the sun. His remaining locks hung to his shoulders, speckling the dark cloth of his coat with flakes of dandruff. His beard was dense, profuse, and untamed. His nose was large, the line of his mouth grim and unyielding. His deep-set eyes were as piercing and fanatical as those of a biblical prophet. Indeed, he carried a small Bible in his right hand, which he stuffed into the pocket of his frock coat as he strode towards Graf Otto.
"This is General Jacobus Hercules Delaray," von Letter Vorbeck introduced him. But before he reached them, Henny ran forward to intercept him and went down on one knee in front of him.
"General Kuss, I beg you to give me your blessing."
Delaray stopped and looked down at him.
"Don't kneel for me. I am not a priest, and I am no longer a general. I am a farmer. Get up, man."
Then he peered more closely at Henny.
"I know your face, but I have forgotten your name. Durant, General. Henny Durant."
Henny beamed with pleasure to be remembered.
"I was with you at Neutgedacht and Eisterspreit."
Those were two of the notable victories the Boers had won during the war. At Eisterspreit, Delaray's flying commando had captured such huge quantities of British stores that the little Boer army had been rejuvenated, given the will and means to fight on for another year.
"Ah, I remember you. You were the one who guided us to the river crossing after the fight at Langlachter, when the Khaki had us surrounded. You saved the commando that night. What are you doing here, man?"
"I came to shake your hand, General."
"That will be my pleasure,"
Delaray replied as he seized Henny's hand in a powerful grip. It was plain to see why his men held him in such awe and reverence.
"Why did you leave the Orange Free State Republic, Henny?"
"Because it was no longer a republic and it was no longer free. They have made it part of a foreign land that they call the British Empire,"
Henny replied.
"It will be a republic again. Then you will come back with me? I need good fighting men like you."
Before Henny could reply, Graf Otto stepped forward.
"Please tell the general that I am deeply honoured to meet such a brave soldier and patriot."
Henny fell quickly and readily into the role of translator, first making the introductions and then taking his place at Delarey's side under the sun awning. At first, both von Letta Vorbeck and the general were stiff and awkward, with Eva at the conference table, and Graf Otto apologized to them.
"I hope you do not mind Fräulein von Wellberg being present at our deliberations. I vouch for her. Nothing that is said here today will go with her when she leaves. The Fräulein is an artist of repute. With your permission, gentlemen, and as a memento of such a historic conclave, I have asked her, while we talk, to make portraits of you."
Von Letta and Delarey nodded. Eva thanked them with a smile, then laid her sketchpad and pencil on the table and began to work. Graf Otto turned back to Delarey.
"You have Henny Durant to translate for you, General. Colonel von Letta Vorbeck and I are fully conversant with English, so that is the language we will use. I hope that this is agreeable to you."
When Henny translated this, Delarey inclined his head, and Graf Otto continued. "First, I want to present a letter of introduction and authority from the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Berlin." He handed it across the table. Henny read it aloud while Delarey listened carefully, then said, "I would not have come such a terrible journey under the sea if I had not known who you are, Graf Otto. Germany was a staunch ally and a good friend of my people during the war with the British. That I will never forget. I look upon you as a friend and an ally still."
"Thank you, General. You do me and my country great honour."
"I am a simple man, Graf. I like straight and honest talk. Tell me why you have invited me here."
"Despite the great courage and determination with which they fought, the Afrikaner people have suffered terrible defeat and humiliation."
Delarey said nothing, but his eyes were dark and tragic. Graf Otto was silent with him for a moment, then went on.
"The British are a warlike and rapacious nation. They have seized and dominated most of the world, and still their appetite for conquest is unassuaged. Although we Germans are a peaceable people, we are also proud and prepared to defend ourselves against aggression."
Delarey listened to the translation.
"We have much in common," he agreed. "We are willing to make a stand against tyranny. It cost us dearly, but I and many like me do not regret it."
"The time is coming on apace when you may be forced to make this decision again. Fight with honour or capitulate with shame and disgrace. Germany will face the same dreadful choice."
"It seems that the fates of our two peoples are linked. But Britain is a terrible enemy. Her navy is the most powerful in all the oceans. If Germany were forced to oppose it, what would be your battle plan? Would the Kaiser send an army to defend your colonies in Africa?"
Delarey asked.
"There are differing opinions on that. The prevailing view in Germany is that our colonies must be defended in the North Sea, not on their own ground."
"Do you subscribe to that view, Graf? Would you abandon your African colonies and your old allies?"
"Before I answer that question, let us review the facts. Germany has two colonies in sub-Saharan Africa, south of the equator, one on the southwest coast and the other here on the east coast. Both are thousands of miles from Germany and widely separated from each other. At present, the forces defending them are tiny. In German southwest Africa, there are approximately 3,000 regular Schutztruppe and 7,000 settlers, most of whom are on the army reserve list or have received military training. Here in German East Africa, the numbers are comparable."
Graf Otto looked at von Letta Vorbeck.
"Am I correct, Colonel?" "Yes, they are very similar. I have 260 white officers and 2,500 askari under my command. In addition, there is a police gendarmerie of 45 white officers and a few more than 2,000 police askaris who will help to defend the colony if it comes to war. It is a pitifully small force with which to defend such a vast territory," the Graf pointed out. "With the British Royal Navy in command of the oceans around the continent, the chance of reinforcing and supplying these two tiny armies would be negligible."
"It is a daunting prospect," von Letta Vorbeck agreed.
we would be forced to adopt the same guerrilla tactics that you Boers employed so successfully in South Africa against them. All that would change most dramatically if South Africa entered the war on the side of Germany, Graf Otto said softly. Both he and von Letta Vorbeck looked hard at Delarey.
None of this is completely new to me. I also have given much thought to these matters, and consulted many of my old companions in arms.
Delarey stroked his beard thoughtfully.
However, Smuts and Botha have gone over heart and soul to the British. They have a grip on the reins of power, a firm but not unshakable grip. A large part of the South African population is of British descent, and their hearts and loyalties lie with Britain.
What is the state of the South African army? Graf Otto asked. What are the numbers, and who is in command?
Without exception, all the senior officers are Afrikaner and fought against the British, Delarey replied. That includes Smuts and Botha, who have gone over to them. However, there are many who have not followed their lead.
The war ended almost 12 years ago, von Letta Vorbeck pointed out. Much has changed since then. All four of the old South African republics have been amalgamated into the Union of South Africa. The Boers have twice the power and influence they had before. Will they be satisfied with this, or will they risk it all by siding with Germany? Are the Boers not tired of war? They are now part of the British Empire. Would Smuts and Botha succeed in turning their old comrades away from Germany?
Von Letta and Graf Otto waited for the old Boer to respond.
You may be right, he said at last. Perhaps time has healed some of the wounds of the Afrikaner folk, but the scars are still there. However, I run ahead of myself. Let us consider the existing Army of South Africa, the Union Defence Force as it is now known. It is formidable, perhaps 60,000 strong and well-equipped. It is quite capable of controlling all of Southern Africa from Nairobi and Windhoek down to the Cape of Good Hope. Whichever government commands it will have control of the sea routes and the harbours around the continent. It will have under its control the monumental resources of the Witwatersrand goldfields, the Kimberley diamond mines, and the new steel and armament works in the Transvaal. If South Africa threw in its lot with Germany, Britain would come under enormous strain. She would have to divert a large army from Europe to try to recapture the country, and the Royal Navy would be stretched to its limit to defend and supply it. South Africa might well be the pivot on which the outcome of such a war would turn.
If you decided to ride against the British again, which way would your old comrades go? We know Botha and Smuts would support Britain. But what of the other old commando leaders? Which way would De Wet, Maritz, Kemp, Beyers, and the others go? Would they be with you or with Botha?
I know these men, Delarey said softly. I have fought with them and seen into their hearts. It was a long time ago, but they have not forgotten the terrible things that the British did to them, their women and their children, and to the land we love. In my heart, I know they would ride out on commando with me against the enemy, and for me the enemy is still Britain.
That is what I hope to hear you say, General. I have been given total authority by the Kaiser and by my government to promise you whatever you require in the way of supplies, arms, and money.
We will need all of those things, Delarey agreed. Especially in the beginning, before we have been able to wrest control from Botha, and before we have seized the army arsenals and the vaults of the Reserve Bank in Pretoria, where the money is.
Tell me what you will need, General. I will get it for you from Berlin.
We will not need food or uniforms. We are the farmers who grow the crops, so we will feed ourselves. We will fight, as we did before, in our workaday clothes. We will not need small arms. Every man of us still has his Mauser.
What will you need, then? Graf Otto persisted.
For a start, I will need 150 heavy machine guns
and 20 trench mortars with the ammunition and bombs for them. Say 1 million rounds of ammunition and 500 mortar bombs. Then we will need medical supplies."
Graf Otto made shorthand notes on his pad as de la Rey enumerated his requirements.
"Heavy cannon?" von Letta Vorbeck suggested.
"No. Our first attacks will rely on speed and surprise. If they succeed, we will capture the government arsenals and the heavy artillery will fall into our hands."
"What else do you need?"
"Money," de la Rey replied simply.
"How much?"
£2 million in gold sovereigns."
For a minute they were all silenced by the enormity of the request. Then Graf Otto said,
"That is a great deal of money."
"That is the price of the richest land in the southern hemisphere. It is the price of an army of 60,000 trained and battle-hardened men. It is the price of victory over the British."
"Do you really believe it to be too high, Graf?"
"No,"
Graf Otto shook his head emphatically.
"When you put it like that, it is a fair price. You shall have the full 2 million. I will see to it."
"All of this, all the money and arms, will be to no avail until it is delivered to our bases in South Africa."
"Tell me how we should get it to you."
"You could not smuggle it through one of the main harbours, not through Cape Town or Durban. Customs surveillance is too strict. However, South Africa has a common border with your colony in the southwest. They are joined by a good railway line. The management and employees of South African railways are almost exclusively Afrikaners. We can rely on them to sympathize with our cause. An alternative route might be from here, in German East Africa, across Lake Tanganyika, by boat, to the copper belt in Rhodesia, and from there south, once again by the railway line."
Von Letta Vorbeck looked grave.
"It would take weeks, or even months, to get the supplies to you by these routes. At every turn there would be danger of the shipment's discovery and interception by the enemy. It would be too risky."
Both men looked to Graf Otto for an alternative plan.
"How could you deliver the goods to us?" de la Rey demanded.
They all waited expectantly for his reply.
Eva went on sketching imperturbably. Obviously she had not followed a single word of the discussion, but Graf Otto glanced at her, then at Henny, and frowned slightly.
For a little longer he remained silent, drumming his fingers on the table, thinking deeply. Then he seemed to reach a decision.
"It can be done.
It will be done. I give you my word, General. I will deliver everything that you need to wherever you need it. But from now on our watchword must be secrecy. I shall inform only you and Colonel von Lettau, much nearer the time, of the method of delivery that we will employ. At this stage I must ask you to trust me."
De la Rey stared at him with those smouldering fanatical eyes, and Graf Otto returned his gaze calmly. At last de la Rey picked up the sheet of paper with the eagle letterhead that still lay on the table in front of him.
"This is the guarantee of your Kaiser and your government. It is not sufficient incentive to persuade me to lead my folk into the Holocaust once again."
Graf Otto and von Letta Vorbeck continued staring at him wordlessly. The whole design seemed on the point of collapse. Then de la Rey went on.
"You have given me another guarantee, Graf. You have given me your word. I know you are a man who has moved great mountains. Your accomplishments are the stuff of legend. I know you are a man who does not even admit the possibility of failure."
He paused again, perhaps to gather his thoughts.
"I am a humble man, but in one respect alone I am proud. I am proud of my ability to judge horses and men. You have given me your word, and now I give you mine. On the day that the scourge of war sweeps across Africa once again, I will be ready for you with an army of 60,000 fighting men at my back. Give me your hand, Graf. From this day on, I am your ally to the death."